This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and since you find us on the podcast, we know you are discerning listeners. Let's get to it. Here's today's show. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening, and they are out there somewhere, armed and dangerous.
There was a hole cut out of the back of the cell through which these inmates escaped. They went onto a catwalk. We estimate they climbed down and had power tools.
These are very dangerous individuals. The state police ask that the public take no chances and report any suspicious activity. They could be literally anywhere.
We can find Bin Laden. We can find these guys, like, no problem.
Governor Andrew Cuomo says David Sweat and Richard Matt left a note behind saying, "Have a nice day."
It was an elaborate plot. We went back and pieced together what they did.
Everybody's shocked. You know, it's never happened. Nobody has ever gotten out of the maximum part of it.
They could be out of state, but they still could be holed up here in Dannemora.
We know how the movie Shawshank Redemption ended. That's where that spooky music came from. Everything else in that montage was real. How will the story of David Sweat and Richard Matt end? The convicted murderers broke out of the Clinton Correctional Facility maximum security section over the weekend. Clinton, in the far north corner of New York State, is also known as Little Siberia. The pair are at large after cutting through a steel wall, slicing into a pipe, smashing through a brick wall without arousing any suspicion, until they were reported absent at a morning roll call. The break has been devastating for a small community where this prison facility is the largest building in town and the largest employer. Everyone in town has a worry or something to say. Joining us is Brian Mann, Adirondack reporter for North Country Public Radio. Brian, thanks for joining us.
Hi, John.
Is there any reason to believe that these two fugitives are at large in the general area of northern New York?
You know, a lot of people are speculating that they're far afield by now, that they've run far and fast. But a lot of the local enforcement, law enforcement investigators we're talking to here say there is still a good chance they're in the deep woods here in one of the abandoned houses or cabins. It's a very remote, empty area. So anything's possible.
And if they could get out of Little Siberia, I suppose they could get across the border into Canada, although that might be a challenge as well. What do you think about that?
Well, if they had documents ready, that's not a tough thing to do. It's very close to the Canadian border. One of the men, Richard Matt, had connections there. He had a girlfriend in Ontario back when his trial was underway. So that's possible. He also had connections in Mexico. There are two airports located pretty conveniently up there in Ottawa and in Montreal. So if this getaway was planned that thoroughly, then yes, they could have used Canada as a conduit to get to just about anywhere in the world.
Now, a prison like Clinton is definitely a part of the community, and in rural communities like this, there are, you know, lots of jobs associated with the prison. What's the speculation like in the community about who, if anyone, might have given assistance to these two?
Yeah, this prison sits literally on Main Street, the big white wall. It's the dominant feature in the village, and there is a lot of conversation about who might have been involved. Governor Andrew Cuomo has speculated that civilian employees or contractors may have been somehow connected with providing them the information or the tools that they needed to carve their way out. And there have been reports of specific individuals being interviewed or interrogated by investigators. A lot of that reporting still seems pretty sketchy to me, so we're not using names or identifiers at this point, but they are definitely focusing a lot of their attention on staff at the prison.
Would the contractors have been from the local area, or would these be contractors that the state corrections facility would use from virtually anywhere in the country?
A lot of these would be local guys. This is a prison that's old, built originally in the 1840s and upgrades through the 1860s. So, you know, you can imagine they're constantly doing repair work, just keeping this thing going. It's a sort of big white fortress that looks like a 19th century, you know, kind of old school out of central casting prison. And so there are guys in and out of there, men and women on the civilian side every day, keeping steam pipes going, keeping all the infrastructure going. So there are a lot of locals and also contractors from around New York State.
Now, we're told that David Sweat and Richard Matt had adjoining cells. Remind us of how long they have served their sentences, so how long they might have known each other, and therefore how long they might have been able to plan this together.
Yeah, David Sweat has been in prison since 2002, and Richard Matt has been in New York prison since 2008, so quite a long time. And I don't know how long their prison cells were adjacent to one another, but one of the things that's unique about Clinton Dannemora is that there is a very strange kind of public yard where all the inmates are allowed to circulate in an area that the prison guards have very little role in. There's a lot of sort of independent inmate activity in this facility. And so there would have been an enormous window of opportunity for them to coordinate, to plan, perhaps to work with other inmates, and even to talk to staff and contractors at the facility. It's a very secure place in terms of getting in and out. But once you're inside, there's a lot of free time and a lot of loose activity for a maximum security prison.
Forgive me for firing a synapse here, but you're describing a scene which seems almost directly taken from Shawshank Redemption, that common area where they were able to sort of go over into a corner and talk about whatever they wanted to talk about. That sort of thing is at this prison?
It's actually more dramatic than that. In Clinton Dannemora, there's a huge section of the prison yard that long ago, by tradition, the staff essentially handed over to the inmates. They have their own plots of land, these tiny little chunks of property upon which they can build things. They have little gardens. They have their own little culture that's built into that section of the yard. It's a remarkable place. And so within that area, there's gang activity, there's racial activity, criminal activity. Really, as many guards have told me over the years, I've been there. That's an area that the inmates essentially govern themselves. It's an old school 19th century kind of prison yard.
How much anxiety has this prison break produced in the local area? And we're talking about a wide area of northern New York.
Yeah, it's really anxious. There are guys with shotguns on corners, checkpoints everywhere. There is real fear. These are bad guys who got away. That part is not at all like the Shawshank Redemption. They're scary people. The other side of this is, as you mentioned, this is an industry up here. This is a way of life, keeping men behind bars. And so for a lot of these corrections officers, a lot of their families, this is a real blow to what they do. They know there are going to be tough questions asked and fingers pointed. People are going to lose their jobs very likely over this. So there's a lot of nervous watching and waiting really across that spectrum.
Brian Mann, Adirondack reporter for North Country Public Radio. Brian, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
Anticipating the interaction of prisoners and staff and the vulnerability of even the most forgettable doorway or window, conduit, or ventilation duct in a prison is the peculiar architectural challenge of prison design. There are also design issues that relate to making prison life livable, if not exactly pleasant, and prison populations docile, if not exactly cheerful, all the time. All of these goals need to be met in the modern prison building. Is it an impossible task? Is maximum security a concrete and steel myth? Mike Brenchley is Senior Vice President and Director of the Justice Program at HDR Architecture.
Well, the best security is really a marriage between the operational protocols and the physical design. And so we focus very keenly on operational philosophy, inmate movement policies, how programs are delivered, and establishment of secure perimeters. And we work very closely with the staff and the operational personnel.
And how's all this evolved? I mean, in the old days, you can actually go to Philadelphia and see that old penitentiary that's still there, made out of stone. And, it was designed originally as a place to rehabilitate prisoners back in the, I think, early 1800s. How has prison design changed?
Well, from, the early 1800s, that was the time when you first started to see single cells around a observation tower in kind of an indirect supervision model. You're right. There was a idea that there was a number of rehabilitative elements to that incarceration. Today, we have evolved into many more observational concepts, many more classifications of security levels, which allow us to tailor the design to the specific facility needs and requirements.
Now, does that mean that it's a fundamentally new challenge to create facilities that are multi-use, that have maximum security in one wing and maybe minimum security in another wing?
No. Typically, you'll have a range of security classifications within any facility, even if a facility is deemed a a medium facility or a maximum level facility, you'll have varying degrees within that facility. Almost every facility has to have some way to have a maximum security unit for administrative use, if nothing else. I mean, if someone doesn't want to follow the rules, they're going to go to that detention area or that maximum security area to be locked down for a while.
Who would you say, what kind of inmate would you say is the absolute enemy of the protocols that you try to design and create? What profile are you thinking of when you think of characters that could really compromise your security strategy?
Really, I think almost any inmate at any security level has time on their hands, as you mentioned earlier, to think about ways to breach whatever security perimeter they're faced with. So really, most of the facilities in the country are in the medium security classification. And so you probably have, just by sheer numbers, more of those inmates.
Well, then, isn't that interesting? Prison breaks are rare. Why would it be the case that a maximum security break seems to be more frequent than, or an attempt seems to be more frequent than minimum and medium security breaks?
Well, I think, obviously, those individuals are usually incarcerated for an even longer period of time than other classifications, and they are usually the most hardened individuals. So they are actually, looking to find a way to breach the security perimeter. On the other hand, you have many more security protocols and operational protocols in place for those facilities to make those actual successful attempts even more rare.
Well, Mike Brenchley, thanks so much.
Well, thank you.
Mike Brenchley is Senior Vice President and Director of the Justice Program at HDR Architecture, focusing on complex institutional prison projects. Sounds like someone went to a lot of trouble to make the annoying buzz of a simple metal milling machine into this spooky soundtrack for a horror movie set in a dentist's office. But it's actually an advertisement for a kind of computer-controlled milling machine that can produce the key component for a gun, an AR-15 assault rifle. And what's so unusual about this mill is that it's not designed for gunsmiths or the military, it's for the general public. It's called the Ghost Gunner, a simple, set-it-and-forget-it part maker to make untraceable, do-it-yourself firearms. Andy Greenberg, senior writer for Wired, did just that at the office of Wired in San Francisco. He made an AR-15.
You know, I have for a long time been writing about this group called Defense Distributed, this very controversial group that wants to make it possible for anyone in the world to make a gun at home, to make a fully functioning lethal weapon. They've tried 3D printing gun components, and now they're selling this machine that's called a CNC mill, a computer-controlled milling machine. Theirs is called the Ghost Gunner, and it's designed to carve gun components out of aluminum. So they sent me this machine to review it for Wired. You know, there's been this movement of DIY gunsmithing for a long time. You know, people have been making the body of an AR-15 so that they can just buy all the other components off the shelf and have this untraceable weapon with no serial number, completely unknown to the U.S. government. That's been very popular among libertarians for many years. But it's required some shop skills, some machining skills. But the revelation was that with this machine, the Ghost Gunner, I could just really install some software, push a few buttons, and it was all automatic, and I had this perfect machine's body of an AR-15 semi-automatic weapon and ended up with a totally untraceable lethal rifle.
And how much did this cost?
Well, the whole process cost a total of $2,200 for the Ghost Gunner mill, this gun-making machine, all the parts of an AR-15, and that's way more than a regular AR-15. But this wasn't a regular AR-15. This is what some people call a ghost gun. That's where the Ghost Gunner takes its name. It's a weapon that was completely private that I made alone. Nobody had any knowledge of its creation. The government didn't know that it existed.
Are you able to obtain the other components for an AR-15 without any kind of background check or any of the regulations that we've come to know regarding purchase of weapons?
Well, that's one of the amazing quirks of American gun control laws, is that the only part of an AR-15 that's regulated is this body piece, the lower receiver. And the lower receiver isn't actually even the most complex part of an AR-15.
What's a lower receiver?
The lower receiver is the body of the gun. Mm. It's kind of the frame that you attach everything else to, including the upper receiver, which contains the barrel and the chamber and the bolt, the place where all the explosions happen. In many ways, you look at an AR-15 and that looks like the gun. But it's this other piece that everything attaches to, like the grip and the stock and the magazine, That's the lower receiver. That's the only part that has any regulation. That's where the serial number goes. And if you can make it yourself, you can skirt all gun control laws and without actually breaking any laws, end up with a gun that doesn't have a serial number, that, you know, has never seen any regulation whatsoever.
Is it the case that making a weapon is legal, whereas buying a weapon, it comes under all kinds of regulations, that this is a giant sort of, you know, libertarian loophole?
Yeah, if I had wanted to buy an AR-15, I would have had to go through a background check. I would have had to certainly show someone ID. But by making this one part, which actually was fairly simple, it's just a kind of metal frame where the trigger and the hammer and all that stuff drops into. And in fact, I didn't even make it from scratch. I finished it from a kind of kit that was 80% finished, as close as you can get to a lower receiver of an AR-15 without actually legally counting as one. By finishing that part, I was able to buy everything else online.
What does law enforcement think of this phenomenon?
Well, in California, there have been a couple of incidents. One mass shooting in Santa Monica used one of these so-called ghost guns. A kid who had mental illness created his own AR-15 and then used it to kill five people. In another incident in Stockton, it sounds like there was another one of these ghost guns, an AK-type weapon. And I think that law enforcement is becoming more aware of this. And a state senator in California actually proposed and had passed a ghost gun ban that would make it necessary to put a serial number on an automatic rifle that you create at home. And then that ban was vetoed by Jerry Brown, the governor of California.
What did it feel like to see this machine spit out this little component that you knew was going to make this gun that you had around you functional?
Well, I spent a week on this project, and I made this lower receiver as part of my experiment three different ways. I, you know, struggled with a manual drill press for a whole day and failed at that. I tried a 3D printer, which worked beautifully, but had some flaws that made it I couldn't assemble it in the end. And then finally used this ghost gunner CNC mill. It was overall it was a technical process, and I was sort of figuring out, this kind of giant game of Legos, how to get all these parts, how to put it all together. And then the moment when it all did kind of come together, when the upper receiver, the barrel, you know, and the chamber and all that kind of attached to the lower receiver with this chink, and suddenly I had the semi-automatic rifle, I did have this moment of realization that, you know, this was no longer just a collection of parts or some kind of technical undertaking. It was, I had created a lethal weapon, and I could kill someone with it if I wasn't careful, and I had to start being careful where I pointed it. It was a bizarre moment.
How are you different, or how is this conversation different from any of the marketing that the libertarians do of telling people, you know, you got to go out and do this. This is the way you're free.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't intend this to be either an advertisement for this technique or an indictment that we need to close this loophole. I write for a technology magazine. And I, rather than kind of add my voice to either side of this incredibly polarized debate, the idea here was just to show how this is done, to show how easy actually it is. I think that that's knowledge that is important for everyone to have, no matter which side of the gun debate you're on.
Reporter Andy Greenberg is a senior writer for Wired. Thanks so much.
Thank you, John.
So how does it further the cause of freedom to make it easy for Americans to make their own untraceable assault rifles and other firearms? We'll put the question directly to Cody Wilson, founder of Defense Distributed, the nonprofit that sold Wired's Andy Greenberg, the Ghost Gunner. That's the computer-controlled milling unit that can machine the parts to make a completely functional and lethal AR-15. Cody Wilson, welcome to The Takeaway, and take that question if you would.
Hey, John. Thanks for having me. How does it benefit freedom? I'm not sure that I'm willing to accept it on those terms, but I'll go for it anyway. It's not just Americans that we're allowing to make this machine. We can sell the machine globally, and we have commodity classification to put it all over the world, even into gun control states, and I'm happy to take it there. Basically, it's an affirmation of political techniques, which are currently, by the dominant situation, deemed to be illegitimate. I think that that's highly in doubt, and I think that I can affect these political strategies with or without sovereign legitimization.
Now, just trying to see through some of that opaque language there, it is your notion here that the principle of government being able to trace weapons is an assault on freedom, in a sense.
Maybe not so directly. And so I would say I would qualify with state government. And I believe there's a conflation happening. There's this desire for observability and for traceability. Like forensics and criminal traceability is understandable. And especially in commerce, it's not unreasonable, I think, to require certain licensed manufacturers to perhaps serialize their weapons. But at the same time, there's also this dominant political need for observing what everyone is making, babysitting what everyone has, the standing reserve that technology affords the private individual. And I believe that this invasive tendency to need to observe what the private individual is doing is inconsistent with this same commercial desire to regulate the commerce of guns.
What's more important to you, the idea that someone, if they want to, can do what your company allows them to do, make their own weapon that is outside of this bubble of observable weapons, as you call them, or would you prefer that everyone has one of these weapons and that the government is completely out of the business of getting involved in firearms whatsoever?
Oh, man, that's a good question. I really don't know how to answer it in the terms that you've offered. I really think what is most valuable in the project, if we can use the term value, is baiting hyper-regulatory mode of, you could say, progressive thought into its terminal conclusions. Actually challenging it to try to keep up with and observe all of the guns that will be made with machinery like this, software that's produced and proliferated from techniques like this, actually baiting that security state to become real is very valuable because it must ultimately lead to the suicide of that kind of power.
But that symbolic hack becomes very, very concrete the moment one of your weapons, manufactured weapons, it gets into the hand of someone that, blows away a kindergarten.
Oh, surely, surely. I think that's
how are you going to feel about that?
Though no more true than it's been before, right? There's maybe, 4 million AR-15s out there in hands already. So I feel like in very meaningful ways, I'm not contributing to a kind of latent criminality that just wishes to express itself and just only can't. If only I can get this $1,500 mill, now I can blow away a class of kindergartners. I believe that there's a bit of disingenuousness there, I think, on the part of, at least as a talking point used by politicians.
Are you worried about Department of Justice, prosecutors coming after you?
They're going to have to try really hard, John. But, I mean, ultimately,
but
right.
They try really hard because you know the law here.
Well, that's just it. I went to law school and they disabuse you of any of these notions like, well, I have the law on my side. Well, the law in the end is just a grab bag of techniques for political operatives to mostly trip you up or use as a spider's web or a dragnet. I don't believe that a government like this one, hostile to what we're doing, will long tolerate what we're doing.
Do you have an AR-15 yourself?
I just bought one like a week ago, and it's strongly ironic because we've produced all these techniques to make them unserialized, and I just bought one at a gun store the other day.
Cody Wilson is the founder of Defense Distributed, the maker of the Ghost Gunner milling machine. Thank you, Cody.
Thank you, John.
Can you hear Wisconsin in those riffs of guitarist Jeff Beck? Well, anyone who knows electric guitar can hear the solid body sound of a Les Paul Custom Black Beauty in that famous track from Jeff Beck's Blow by Blow album from the 1970s. And Les Paul, who would have turned 100 today, had Wisconsin in his blood. Wizard of Waukesha helped invent the solid body electric guitar and then spent nearly 8 years convincing Gibson to manufacture it in the 1950s, a guitar that at one time accounted for half of Gibson's total sales.
When you just get mixed up and there's too much going on, then it's time to pick up your guitar, whether it's in the kitchen or just someplace where you can just play your guitar and clear your head.
That's Les Paul speaking to our partner, the New York Times, in 2008, still performing in his 90s. And if all the famous Les Paul players showed up on his 100th birthday party, that would be some greatest hits album. Rudy Pensa will sell you a new or fine vintage Les Paul at Rudy's Music in Manhattan, which has been open for more than 3 decades. Welcome, Rudy.
Welcome. Hello.
What does that solid body sound mean for rock and roll and for the people who played it, the many guitarists?
Well, that was his... I guess he was tormented by that. Most of the guitars was arched ups and... But he had a vision. He had the sound and the ears, I'm sure. I actually asked Les a few times. Yeah, he said, I wanted to be able to play. And I mean, listen, to play rock, stuff like that, you know, I love Arch Taps. It's actually my passion, but it doesn't cut it to play, you know. A true Arch Tap, the pickup is not in the guitar, it's floating pickup. And it gives a lot of feedback, you can play loud, you know. The solid body is just a game to actually create the rock and roll that we love today from all these huge bands, you know, Led Zeppelin, you name it. And that's what all these people, they got attached so much to the point, I mean, look today. I mean, thank God, the guitar is back. And a solid body is a big part of our sound.
So if I was to make a photo album of the artists who've come into your shop over the past 30 years and wanted to play a Les Paul solid body, what are the names that would be in that photo album?
Oh, my God, you need to make a big photo.
Yeah.
Well, you know, one of my buddies is Mark Knopfler.
From Dire Straits?
Yeah, a guy who we met in 79. He was in the city looking for a studio for his second album. And just I was just blasting Sultan Swing, you know, and he came to the shop, becoming great friends. And, well, at least, I mean, I basically met everyone. I mean,
John McLaughlin?
Yeah, John was in the shop. And, I mean, even Les, of course, was in the shop. And you name it.
Rudy, let me say, you've aged better than a lot of those old rockers.
I don't know. I don't know what it is, but I was born to love instruments. You don't have to be an Eric Clapton or Mark Knopfler. You don't have to be one of those guys. You can just play one note and enjoy. I just love it.
That's Les Paul's idea. You know, he wasn't the best player in the world,
absolutely,
but he just said, do it to clear your head. That's
absolutely. Right. I mean, look at the alternative. What are you going to be watching? What a disaster is going on in the world. If music would be introduced to those young kids, everyone would love it. I mean, it's a beautiful thing.
Turn off YouTube, play the guitar.
Absolutely.
Let's say happy birthday to Les Paul.
Oh, I even the sky is crying today.
Ah, that's very sweet.
Yeah.
Happy birthday to Les Paul, who would have turned 100 today. That's Rudy Pensa, owner of Rudy's Music in Manhattan, a shop that's been open for more than 3 decades. Back to the good old days in New York music. Rudy, thanks so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's all for today, but we want your feedback, and we want you to sign up for our texts. You can get one text per day. We ask you a question featured on the next day's show. As a member of the Listener Response Network, your voice becomes part of our on-air conversation. Just text the word START to 69866. That's START to 69866. Messaging and data rates may apply. You can reply STOP to opt out. You can also ask me anything on Twitter. I'll take your questions, comments, even your complaints. Find me. I'm at Jay Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide, with personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem solving. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.